To achieve these improvements, our architects have not only applied the remarkable discoveries of modern technology, but have also brought to bear the fruits of their own researches on orientation, natural illumination, sound control, safety, cleanliness, and many other kindred fields. Although it is the usable space within buildings that motivates us to build them, it is the walls, floors, and roofs which define this space, and which, curiously enough, most people mean when they speak of buildings. For the construction of this enclosing shell, the architect selects appropriate materials for the supporting structure and the visible finished surfaces that complete it. In doing this, skilled modern architects can contribute to our needs for usable space by creating buildings which are at once strong, durable, and economical both in first cost and maintenance. These are important factors in a day when so many building needs must be satisfied within limited resources. Of equal importance with utility, safety, and economy is the constant influence our buildings have upon the well-being of our minds and spirits. We all react consciously or subconsciously, but nevertheless very positively, to the sense stimuli arising from our environment. And since our buildings are so prominent in this environment, their cumulative and continuing effect is a powerful factor in our mental and emotional health. If our buildings are ugly and repelling, if they infect us with pettiness, confusion, meanness, and frustration, they lay an inescapable burden upon us all, whether or not we recognize or admit the cause. If, on the other hand, they are attractive, beautiful, and orderly, they can caress our eyes, cheer our hearts, lift our morale, and fortify our faith in our ability to master the material paraphernalia of our existence. Beautiful buildings are indeed a solace we can well afford. Individual buildings are not isolated entities, but rather components of the whole community, which itself forms a sort of super building wielding similar impacts on us all. In function and appearance, our communities should conform to standards of quality comparable to those used in judging excellence in buildings. Architecture and city planning thus merge into a single and inseparable endeavor to bring physical and visual order into our communal life. Their complementary benefits can do much to help us in our striving to attain a gracious, satisfying existence. Because architecture grows from the very roots of social needs, aspirations, and capabilities, and because it forms such a tangible embodiment of these intangible realities, buildings have long been recognized as legitimate and telling symbols of the society and civilization that call them into being. Athens, Parthenon, the imperial plazas and huge vaulted baths of ancient Rome, the transcendent soaring cathedrals of Gothic France, the ordered grandiloquence of Louis XIV's palace at Versailles, and the shimmering domes of the mosques of Isfahan all epitomize the finest technical and cultural achievements of their times. But despite such triumphs, we recognize today that an age cannot solely be judged by the most luxurious palace or its holiest precinct. Architecture must serve all men, and thus each age must be held accountable as well for its sordid hovels, its tawdry shops, and vindictive factories that too often comprise the building equipment of all but a privileged few. For our own day, our finest buildings symbolize dramatically many of our most admirable traits. We boast of our towering skyscrapers, sturdy in structure, fabulous in equipment, efficient in operation and so speedily erected. We vaunt our sleek and humming industrial plants and our comfortable, expansive suburban homes. Our best schools, hospitals, and institutions equal, if not surpass, the finest of any land. And in many other categories, we can take legitimate pride in our accomplishments. On the other side of the ledger, dispassionate observers find much of squalor, discord, ineptness, neglect, callousness, and plain vulgarity. Some 24 millions of our peoples are still forced to occupy over 6 million dwellings that a decade ago were so decayed that only major repairs could make them pass a pitifully low minimum standard. Despite much talk and some worthy efforts, our slums still vie with the world's worst. Probably less than 5% of us reside in neighborhoods planned according to accepted modern practice. Probably more than half of our stores are actual liabilities to the businesses they house. Too often, our downtown districts are graceless shambles of shabby, outworn relics embroidered in strident neon. Our civic furniture, the signs, the traffic islands, hydrants, mailboxes, lampposts, and trash cans form a heterogeneous litter that seems to have been designed by the lowliest denizen of City Hall to add expressly to our jarring visual jungle. Surely the picture is not a happy sight, nor one to accept with resignation or complacence. The stimulating vitality of urban America is undeniable, but few of us would claim aesthetic merit for its total effect. There are apologists who feel that it is too much to ask that our cities should be works of art, or that a vibrant, energetic people should be concerned with the amenities of their environment. They cite our national usefulness and the lack of any acknowledged arbiters to dictate correct taste. But 160 years of national existence should have given by now some measure of maturity, and unless the corollary of democracy is ugliness, a proposition we cannot afford to admit, we must somehow cultivate a spontaneous desire for civic comeliness. We do not want a harmony imposed by a dictatorial aristocracy of taste. Nor is it a question of uniformity in this or that style. Living communities will not tolerate straitjackets. But neither can we afford to leave the character of our environment to be the prey of thoughtlessness, niggardliness, or selfish exploitation. There was a time in many communities of colonial America when the desire for civic attractiveness provoked vigilant supervision and control, when civic leadership in such matters was an acknowledged virtue rewarded by respect. At many of our older towns, a fountain, a quiet park with benches, a formal square, or an institution generously housed still reveals the desire of some local citizen to enhance his native community. Today, there are few such benefactors left. In a democracy, therefore, civic beauty must depend upon the desire of the people themselves for an architectural setting worthy of their past, their present, and their future. It will take a vigorous and carefully planned campaign to convince our people that this is an essential task. It can be done, for stranger things than that have been sold the American public. The achievement of civic beauty presupposes both architectural and city planning in the best sense. The utilitarian and economic advantages of such measures are no longer controversial. And it cannot be long before aesthetic amenities, too, will be recognized as imperative. The cost of attractiveness will be negligible, since we will build and rebuild in any case, and since we aim not at ostentatious display, but at order, finesse, and a nice adjustment of essential forms to appropriate function. When such a principle is at last understood, an enlightened public opinion will remove the exercise of bad taste and crude civic manners from the realm of individual prerogative. In such an endeavor, American architects can render signal service, but none but the people themselves can demand and accomplish it. The reward will be a quality of architectural setting and urban environment that could regenerate our common life. Through it, architecture, in its broadest sense, the indispensable art for all men, could become the noblest triumph of our collective enterprise and the manifestation to our progeny that we were the masters of the physical expression of our own destiny.
You've been listening to Professor Turpin C. Bannister head of the Department of Architecture at the University of Illinois, discussing architecture and the American people today. Professor Bannister has been president of the Society of Architectural Historians, editor of the Journal of the Society of Architectural Historians, architectural editor of the New York State Guide, author of numerous important articles on architectural history, and an advisor on a great many survey committees. Our American Culture, every Monday and Friday morning at 10 o'clock, features Professor Royden Dangerfield next Monday, head of the Department of Government and Public Affairs. His subject, Government Made and Remade in America. You will enjoy hearing a companion piece to this program, Masterpieces in English, Wednesdays at 10. Next Wednesday, Professor Charles Shattuck of the Department of English discusses Bernard Shaw and his play, Heartbreak House. For both of these series, tune in to your University of the Air every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 10. This is WILL with studios on the campus in Urbana-Champaign.